Recently, a boarding school in Keokuk was raided by law enforcement. This hour, allegations that include sexual abuse, child pornography, and child endangerment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll start by talking with investigative reporter Lee Rood about the unfolding story surrounding Keokuk's now-closed Midwest Academy. Then, Apple versus the FBI and why we as consumers should care. The Zika infection is found in an Iowa traveler. The legal battle over whether images of ISU's mascot may appear next to pot. Learning from virtual soldiers at the University of Iowa. And a preview of the Hinterland Music Festival. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up a little bit later in the program, the Zika infection now in Iowa. I guess it was found in an Iowa traveler. We'll hear about that and see if that poses an increased danger to us Iowans. Also, learning from virtual soldiers at the University of Iowa. Toward the end of the program, a preview of the Hinterland Music Festival. But first, this disturbing story. At the end of last month, a boarding school in the southeast Iowa town of Keokuk, known as the Midwest Academy, was the target of a two-day raid by law enforcement. A report by the Des Moines Register found about 80 law enforcement calls have happened in the last year. For the next few minutes, we want to explore this unfolding story, the allegations of abuse, questions of transparency, possible legal action against this now-closed academy. Joining us to do that, Lee Rood, investigative and reader's watchdog reporter at the Des Moines Register. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm fine today. Let's start at the beginning. What prompted the raid, the raids that took place late last month?
Well, what we know so far is that there was a 17-year-old former student at the academy who reported some sort of sex abuse. From what I know from the county attorney, two employees corroborated that report of sex abuse. I believe it was also reported to the Department of Human Services. So following that, I think that state authorities got in touch with the FBI's and the DCI here in Iowa, and the raids were conducted on January 28th and 29th.
What was uncovered in those raids?
Well, it's not all clear. One of the things that we were trying to look into typically before a search warrant is served on a property, you would file an application publicly for that warrant. And then afterward, you would file a return saying what was found on the premises. That didn't happen in this case. And so the Register has actually filed a petition to release the search warrant documents. But we know from what we've learned so far, and especially yesterday, that Ben Train, the owner of Midwest Academy, was the suspect in the sex abuse case. That came out in a motion to seal the search warrant documents that was filed by the county attorney in Lee County.
Mm-hmm. You've been trying to get a hold and get no response from Ben Train to talk with him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did a background check here in Iowa. He doesn't have any sort of criminal record. He's 37 years old. I'm told he has three children. He's been at the academy for quite a while, and he is beloved by a lot of the family, the parents who have taken kids there, and some of the kids who have been at the academy over the years.
Mm-hmm. As you piece this together, Lee, what are the possible charges that you're finding here?
Well, we know from the motion to seal that some of the charges being considered are sexual abuse, child pornography, child endangerment, fraudulent practices, ongoing criminal conduct, and then, of course, the sex abuse of the 17-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the teaching methods at this school. Who, a little profile of it. How do they put themselves out there? How do they brand themselves? And who ends up coming to this school?
Well, they brand themselves, they market themselves as a sort of therapeutic environment for troubled teens.
Mm-hmm.
But they promise sort of a tough discipline approach to turning them around. The teens that we have talked to have said that they've had just problems with basic discipline, maybe drug problems, a variety of just kind of rebelling or acting out, skipping school, stuff like that. So.
Mm-hmm. And you've been talking to teens. Have they corroborated any of the assertions, the allegations, then when you've talked to them?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern, and maybe why federal authorities are involved here, is that teens are uniformly reporting that they were held in isolation and restrained. Mm. And there was a boys' wing to the school and a girls' wing to the school, and those isolation rooms that they were put in when they were being disciplined were a little different. But they reported that the teens who were there being held sometimes days at a time with very little food, or not enough food in any rate, sometimes without bedding or something to sleep on. The teens tell me that if in the early days that they were – or in the early months that they were at the school, there was no way to really report child abuse to anyone, not to their parents, not to call 911, not to be able to call the Department of Human Services.
Mm-hmm. In this day and age with cell phones and all the things that teens have these days, they would be locked in rooms and unable to contact anybody outside of this academy?
So they have this sort of graduated discipline system where the kids have told us that, you know, the boys, their hair may be shaved off. They take their shoes away. They have no technology, no cell phones, no access to computers at all whatsoever. And then based on your behavior, you're allowed to move up and, in fact, kind of oversee other youths or mentor or even discipline yourself, other youths who are in the program.
Mm-hmm. Have you been in touch or tried to get in touch with parents of these teens?
Yes, and you'll hear very mixed reviews from parents. Some parents say they were, you know, there's a big shortage of these kinds of programs that deal just with kids with severe behavior problems and drug problems generally in the country. But so the parents that we talked to say they were absolutely desperate to find some place to put their kids, and they were worried that if they didn't do something, they could put their lives at risk or drop out of school, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, they would talk to other parents, get online, and that's how they would find Midwest Academy. So the parents give very, very mixed results. Some have told me that their children have been diagnosed with PTSD after going there. Others remain grateful to this day for what the school was able to offer.
That whole range of reactions there. Mm-hmm. My reaction, as I'm sure many listening to this conversation, is don't we have oversight in place in this state to make sure this doesn't happen? These are unproven allegations at this point, but mm-hmm. The picture that we're getting here is horrific and really gut-wrenching.
So I think that's the thing that's really kind of stunned most of us who've been watching this unfold, is that there is no state oversight. The Department of Education wasn't involved because the department didn't even consider the academy a school under state law. DHS had not been involved in licensing this facility in any way. So it wasn't monitoring the kids who went there, who were mostly private pay customers. So they weren't coming out of the foster care system, say. And not even the state fire marshal had been there to sort of, you know, check out the buildings. So that's upset some lawmakers. I know that Senator Herman Kornbach out of Ames has come up with some legislation that would require the licensing of these kinds of facilities. And we'll see what happens in the legislature this year on that.
Mm-hmm. So what's going on now with the investigation? What can you ferret out that the authorities are doing at this point?
Well, I mean, they've said that this investigation is going to take a while. There are many prongs to it. You know, there's the sex abuse and investigation that's going on, but there's also this look into the use of isolation and restraint. 28 child abuse assessments happened on site when the raid happened. We know that there have already been 19 confirmed abuse cases before the raid. And then there's the whole there's also some concern or allegations of possible overbilling or fraudulent practices. So we have no idea really when charges may or may not happen. The Register has its court date next Friday in its argument to try to unseal the rest of the search warrant documents. So that's what's next for us. And then in the meantime, we continue to investigate.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, in your investigation, we're wondering how many other academies, so-called academies, are out there like this that could be just slipping out of oversight.
Well, that's the tricky thing. Ben Train has gone to great lengths to kind of distance himself from a network of schools like this. We know that the owner of the man who initially came to buy the property that Midwest is on was the founder of that network. And I think the New York Times reported that something like 22 of these affiliated schools have been shut down because of similar child abuse allegations, both in the U.S. and abroad. And we do not know how many of those schools still exist. But Ben Train said that several years ago, he said there's no affiliate. Well, he told us there's no affiliation with that network.
Okay. We'll continue to follow the story. Lee Rood, thank you for giving us the details up to this point, investigative and readers watchdog reporter at the Des Moines Register. Thanks for coming into the studio, Lee.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've heard this week how Apple is resisting aiding the FBI obtain iPhone data associated with one of the San Bernardino attackers. A federal magistrate ruled Tuesday that Apple must help FBI agents to get into one of the terrorists' iPhones by disabling a feature that will lock them out after 10 unsuccessful tries. Doug Jacobson is with us, joining us again, director of Iowa State University's Information Assurance Center. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
So the FBI wants to get at the data to find out, of course, where it may lead and find out possible connections these attackers had with others. What does the FBI actually want, and why is Apple resisting?
The FBI wants Apple to basically produce a new version of the Apple operating system to download to that phone. And that new version would enable the FBI to try all possible keypad combinations to guess the suspect's passcode.
Okay, so it's unlimited. It doesn't lock you out after 10. They can just keep firing passwords at it until they crack it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and there's a relatively small number of passwords, so it's something they could do in a reasonable amount of time. Mm-hmm. If Apple would provide this new version of the operating system.
What is Apple's argument against doing this?
They have a couple arguments. One is a trust argument, that they build a product that enables the users to be secure. And what the FBI is asking them to do is to develop a version that is not secure that could be used to break the security they built into the phones. So it's partially a customer trust. They also are arguing it's a slippery slope. You know, is the FBI going to come back next time and say, well, now you need to build something else to get into this? And this is a little different than a situation where you're trying to compel the software vendor, like an email vendor, to turn over emails, because that's something they have. They're actually asking Apple to write new software to disable security features. And so Apple's going, this is unprecedented.
Right. I see in the news also that the antivirus software creator John McAfee says he'll break this encryption on this killer's iPhone. He said it will take about 3 weeks and that he and his team will do it for free. It comes at a time when McAfee is campaigning as a U.S. presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, just by coincidence, I guess. But it brings us to the question, why doesn't the FBI just get someone to do this, hire a team, not involve Apple?
Well, to overwrite the operating system, it actually takes a secret key that only Apple knows. So nobody could create a version of the operating system to replace the current one. Now, I haven't quite seen exactly, he hasn't really said exactly what McAfee hasn't really said what he's proposing to do. But if his proposal is to try to actually break the underlying encryption. You can get a copy of all the data on a cell phone. But the act of breaking that encryption is a pretty complicated act, and I'm not sure I'm convinced of his 3-week story.
Do you see a solution here that might satisfy both parties?
There's a potential, because the other argument Apple makes is that if we give this software to the FBI, they could use it everywhere. So a potential solution is FBI gives Apple a phone. Apple creates a single version of this operating system to do this one time, and then destroys it, or it's under their control. That doesn't fix their argument of, okay, 6 months from now the FBI comes back and says, now you need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it does fix the potential argument of this software was handed to the FBI and now what are they going to do with it?
Should we consumers care about this encryption battle?
Yes and no. The particular nuances of this battle, that's not really something we should necessarily care about. But I think this really goes along the whole discussion that we've been having for a year now with the Snowden revelations, that there is a trade-off between privacy and certain types of rights and the government's ability to go in and execute or warrants or to prosecute, etc. And this is a new battle that we're fighting in the digital world. This battle used to play out in the physical world. That's where the Miranda rights came from and things like that. So this is new territory.
Mm-hmm. How much are you surprised by this situation, or someone who knows these things intimately, as you do at the Information Assurance Center, cybersecurity knows a lot about that. Is this something that was bound to happen with some time that anybody could have predicted?
I think so. That this battle has been looming. We've heard discussions of Congress trying to create laws to make sure there's back doors in encryption. They tried this 15 years ago and it was an utter failure. This issue has come about occasionally of this ability, right of privacy versus the government's ability to look at something.
Mm-hmm.
And encryption, we've now created technologies that the government, nobody actually can open up. And so the technology's enabled some interesting discussions that are going to take place.
Okay, we have just a few seconds left, but can you tell us how far hackers, cyber criminals, have evolved in the past 10 to 15 years, not only in terms of their sophistication, but also in terms of their criminal goals? It used to be people just did this for kicks, right?
Yeah. It used to be kind of a fun thing to do in the afternoon. The goals have drastically changed. Money, criminals can make a large amount of money with a successful cyber attack. Credit cards can go upwards of $100 a piece if you can steal credit cards, getting bank information. So really what we've seen in the last 5-10 years is the ability for the criminal element to monetize cyber attack. Before that it was just in essence kids having fun, and now it's criminals making money.
Okay. Doug Jacobson, director of Iowa State University's Information Assurance Center. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before the break, let's talk a little bit about this legal tussle continuing between a group of Iowa State University students who want to use that school's logo and the administration of ISU trying to stop them. ISU's chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, it goes by the acronym NORML, attempted to use the school's mascot, that would be Psy, of course, alongside a marijuana leaf on a T-shirt. The school tried to stop them. Now, a district judge ruled in the students' favor. That was in January, and the administration has filed an appeal. Vanessa Miller, excuse me, is with us, higher education reporter at the Gazette. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
The arguments on each side, give us those briefly.
Sure. So the Iowa State students contended they They submitted their T-shirt designs. Those T-shirt designs were approved. They ended up in a photo on the register, in the Des Moines Register, and some lawmakers saw that and were concerned. So they expressed concern to President Leaf at Iowa State, and were worried that Iowa State was shown sort of advocating for the legalization of marijuana, which is what the normal group does. So the administrators rescinded the approval of that shirt and then actually changed their guidelines to make it so that the students couldn't use like a cannabis leaf or the Psy logo or anything on their shirts. The students are arguing that their First Amendment rights were violated, saying that no other groups were treated that way and that they were alone and that they essentially couldn't make any T-shirts with any designs that used the national normal logo. And obviously the administration said that the students weren't in compliance with their policies and that they weren't singled out. The normal group actually obtained emails, though, showing some of this back and forth conversation about the pushback from lawmakers, mm-hmm. and that was the concern, that they wanted to nip this in the bud right off from the start of it, you know, and wanted to make sure that there wasn't any perception that Iowa State was advocating for the legalization of marijuana.
So it looks like really that the pressure was applied from legislators to the ISU administration, and they reacted to that.
Right, exactly, that they were concerned about the perception. So they just really specifically targeted normal here and took back their designs and then gave them a different process for approval of future designs and changed their guidelines. Mm-hmm. And obviously a judge agreed that was discrimination to some degree and in violation of the student's First Amendment right.
Mm-hmm. We just have just over a minute left. So the appeal, can we gauge the chances of this appeal by the ISU administration?
Well, I have to say the judge was pretty definitive on his findings. I mean, he was explicit saying that Iowa State administrators took action specifically directed at normal based on their views and the political reaction to those views. And so it seems like, you know, this is going to go to a different judge, but it seems like the first court really strongly sided with the students and even took away the immunity of the administrators, meaning that they could be held personally liable for whatever violations are found in this case.
And very quickly, what are the chances we'll see Psy the Cardinal with any pot images on a T-shirt in the near future?
Pretty good. The students who are in charge now, they are not in charge, but they're in touch with the students there. They're saying, I can't wait to see what new T-shirt designs we come up with. So they're definitely going to get creative with their newfound freedom, apparently.
Okay. Thank you very much for the update. Vanessa Miller, higher education reporter at the Gazette. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about how the Zika infection has been found now in an Iowa traveler. It's supposedly the first confirmed case of a Zika infection. Also, learning from virtual soldiers at the University of Iowa. And also a preview, some music to end our program today. The Hinterland Music Festival, now in its second year. We'll talk with its director. That's toward the end of the program. Now a short break. We'll be back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to have short conversations to catch up on some of the news we didn't get to otherwise during the week on our talk shows. Santos and Sophia are two soldiers who will never see actual combat. That's because they aren't real people. They're simulations. They're part of the Virtual Soldier Research Program at the University of Iowa. And recently that program received another $2.6 million in grants from the Office of Naval Research. That adds to the research program's external funding, which now totals nearly $40 million. Now, the virtual research team is working on a program to predict and prevent certain types of injuries in Marines. Kareem Abdul-Malik is with us, principal investigator of the virtual soldier program at the University of Iowa. Kareem, welcome back.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
For those who don't know, tell us how this works, the virtual soldier, how Santos and Sophia do what they do.
The virtual soldier, just to explain what it is, it's a human being that we're trying to replicate inside a computer. And so it's not a robot. It's a characterization of a human being, a soldier, Santos, and his counterpart, Sophia, that can do things inside a computer. You give them a task, and they come back, and they test that task, and they tell you whether they're able to do it or not. If they're not able to do it, why, whether they have a joint pain or whether it's too much stress on their spine. It all began while working for the military for Tank Automotive Command Center. They were designing vehicles, and they wanted to test these vehicles inside a computer before they're made. Mm-hmm. So it's all about virtual prototyping, cutting cost and time.
The human body is so complex, Kareem, we don't even understand how it works in a lot of ways. It's one thing to replicate and simulate a car or something like that, but to simulate a human being, that's really a task.
It is, and that's a great question. Let me answer that way. You know, today you can go to a doctor and you say, hey, my age is this, that, and my body mass ratio. They put you on a treadmill and they say, you know, at 5-degree incline, if you walk for 5 minutes, your heart rate ought to be exactly this. And if it's beyond that by 10%, something is not right. We got to check into it. So we take all of that information, which has been gathered for years and years and years, and we try to what we call model and simulate it. So we get all of this info, we model and simulate it, we put it inside a computer, it becomes the human body for Santos and Sophia. Same thing in the biomechanics area, which biomechanics means the joints, the forces on the joints, the skeleton behind it, the muscles underneath. And so we put all of this information together, and it becomes the virtual human body.
Give us an example of what Santos or Sophia might be tasked with, a task that the Defense Department would be interested in finding out about.
Yeah, so right now the software is being used by the U.S. Marines, particularly an entity called the Marine Expeditionary Rifle Squad, they call it MERS. That's an entity that decides on every aspect of equipment, gear that goes on the Marine. And to test that, you know, every day companies design new backpacks, new visors, new helmets, armor, weapons. And to test these things, they have to bring in hundreds of Marines, set up tests all around the country in different situations, different environments. And they have to test them, whether these equipment work and whether they work efficiently. What Santos and Sophia can do is cut that time and cost in using simulation. Mm-hmm. So you can test these equipment virtually inside a computer and get, you know, maybe not 100% accurate answer, but at least a great understanding of what the gear and the equipment have in terms of an effect on the soldier, mm-hmm, or on the Marine.
You mentioned measuring joint pain. How does a virtual soldier feel joint pain? I certainly do in the morning, but I'm wondering how someone who is on a screen in a computer does.
Yeah, it's all in the field of what we call biomechanics. And so just very similar to your car, when you go to change the tires, there's a torque wrench that, you know, they use to measure the torque on the bolts. And very similar to that, we have torques on each joint that we have. And so at your knee, for example, you know, given your weight, your inertia, your height, your body build, and so on, what sort of load you're carrying, there are torques generated at each joint, and we're able to calculate those, predict those in the virtual world, and we, of course, it's validated, so we try to make sure that the predictions are very similar to what the actual soldiers and Marines sustain on an everyday basis.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are variations in real people all the time. This is an average.
No, we actually take variation into account, so you know, you're able to really design your Santos inside the computer. You can make him a very tall guy, but not so strong. Or you can make him a tall guy, but has a lot of strength and not so much fatigue. And so these parameters are things that we vary, and you're able to design your person and say, well, you're a female 20-year-old today. Try to go carry that box, and that box is 80 pounds. And Sophia will come back and say, I'm sorry, but you know, my back pain, the stress, the torque on my back is higher than I can sustain.
Mm-hmm. Will Sophia actually talk to you, or is that text that is put in? Do you just say, there's Sophia, let's put a box in your virtual environment, go move it from point A to point B, or how does that work?
We've tried the talking part, voice synthesis. It didn't work in terms of an interface, and so it's much more point and click. You drag a box in, you assign the box mass, and you say you give a command to Sophia to try to execute that task.
Uh-huh. Does Sophia and Santos, do they ever seem like real people?
That's a great question. I think their brain is not as developed. I always tell people it's probably a 9-year-old or 10-year-old brain, which is wonderful for me. I get along with them very well. You know, as we go along, we're trying to put much more what we call artificial intelligence in them, so they can think on their own a little bit more than what they do today.
Mm-hmm. Are there other applications outside of the military that consumers may be interested in, or just products produced for consumers?
Yes, actually, we're working on several, but let me just give you, historically, we've worked with Ford and GM and Chrysler and Rockwell Collins here in Iowa, Caterpillar as well, and all these manufacturing companies would like to reduce injury. And so in designing assembly lines, for example, they want to make sure that before they design the line, they position people right, their postures are correct, their ergonomic work is all correct as well. And so we've worked with them to accomplish these things to minimize injury. In terms of a consumer, we're trying to work now on things to do with physical therapy, using the Santos software to understand, for example, if somebody has back pain, they go to a physical therapist. The physical therapist can run the software that mimic that particular person and try to tell you that, well, maybe, you know, the symmetry in your body is not correct, therefore you have to exercise your right hip joint a little bit more.
Mm, this is all very fascinating, Kareem. Take this a few years into the future to things that you can't realize now, but you can imagine realizing with virtual soldiers, virtual people, Santos and Sophia, as they grow up a little bit.
You know, that's a very hard one. When we started this, I couldn't imagine that we would be here 12 years later doing stuff that I couldn't think about. I think we just scratched the surface. I think what's coming is truly fascinating, and I can't imagine whether it's helping with sports. My dream would be that the Olympics committee sometime, you know, in the future comes back and says, well, for this particular long jump, for that athlete, can you tell me how to improve their exercise, their practice, such that they can perform better? Mm. If we can accomplish that, that'd be great. But the whole idea for consumers as well, as you know, virtual reality has become so prevalent, and it's coming in a big way from large companies such as Facebook and Google and so on. And I can't imagine that we will not have living people inside our virtual reality, personal virtual reality, living, interacting with you, assisting you in some things, whether you forget something, they can remind you, or whether you can predict into the future and, you know, want to shop online and that person can go and try things on for you.
Oh, you can have someone try a jacket or some boots on for you online who is identical to your proportions, your muscles, and so forth?
You know, there's a lot of people working on this today, and they've been successful at doing shoes, other things that are very rigid, not so much that you wear on the body. But, you know, you asked me to look into the future, and I can't imagine but seeing this happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
Wow. Kareem Abdul-Malik is the principal investigator of the Virtual Soldier Program at the University of Iowa. Just received another grant from the Office of Naval Research. Thank you for giving us an update, Kareem.
Thank you so much, Ben. Appreciate it.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River. To round off the week on Fridays, we like to have short conversations about some news items that we didn't get to otherwise. Well, this just in today, the Zika virus is now in Iowa. Our state has recorded its first confirmed Zika virus infection. The older, unidentified woman with it recently traveled to Central America, according to our state health officials and department spokeswoman, says that the woman became ill but did not require hospitalization. We've all heard about this mosquito-borne Zika virus lately, and the alarming part that pregnant women who become infected can give birth to babies with small heads. Now, more than 80 cases have been reported across the U.S. All of those people apparently traveled to areas where this virus is spreading. That's, you know, Central America, Mexico, South America, the Caribbean. Brad Blitvich is with us, associate professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at Iowa State University. He studies mosquito-transmitted viruses. In fact, he co-authored a Zika virus paper. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for asking me to be on the show.
Dr. Patricia Quinn-Lisk, our Iowa Department of Public Health medical director, says that this first case is not a sign of imminent danger to the population, to us. Do you agree?
Yes, I do agree, because it appears that the major mosquito species that transmits Zika virus is a mosquito known as Aedes aegypti. And this mosquito species is found in tropical and subtropical regions of the world. So it's very common throughout Latin America. But this particular mosquito species is not found in Iowa. It is found in Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. So I suspect there'll be Zika virus cases in those three states. But it'll be extremely unlikely that there'll be cases of Zika virus in Iowa as a result of mosquito bite.
Mm-hmm. And so while it's quite warm, we're all enjoying the break from the cold weather here in Iowa. It would take, for instance, if you had the right type of mosquito, which we don't have in Iowa, which you just said, Brad, if that right type of mosquito bit this infected woman, could that then mosquito become a carrier, infect someone else? Is that the way it works?
Yes, that's correct. So it's maintained in a human mosquito transmission cycle, this virus. So, yep, if this lady was bitten by an Aedes aegypti mosquito, that mosquito could become infected. But luckily for us, that particular species is not found here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, the most alarming thing here, worrying thing, is the effect that it can have on pregnant women who become infected. What are the range of symptoms that those infected can show?
So actually, 80% of people that become infected actually show no symptoms whatsoever, so they don't even know they're infected. In the other 20%, they get symptoms such as fever, rash, joint pain, muscle pain, and conjunctivitis.
Mm-hmm. And from there, you can get infected, and then if you're not a pregnant woman, you just don't even notice it.
That's correct. In 80% of cases, the person doesn't know, whereas in the other 20, there are symptoms. But really the big problem is the birth defects, which are being reported, which Zika virus may be associated with. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, these poor kids are born with, microcephaly, so that's small heads. And also there appears to be incomplete brain development. So these poor kids will, you know, have neurological malformations. And there also appear to be eye defects in these children. So what exactly that will mean later in life, we're not too sure. So whether these kids will have correct vision or not is another issue.
Where is the point of the research spear right now, or points right now? What is most urgently in need of doing?
Well, I think developing a vaccine is very, very important. So that's probably one of the main issues is developing a vaccine. And also we do not completely understand which mosquito species transmit this virus. I mean, it appears to be Aedes aegypti, but really we need to do experiments to confirm whether or not other species can actually have a minor role in the transmission of this virus.
It's not unthinkable. It's not unthinkable, is it, that this virus could change to be able to live in other types of mosquitoes, right?
I mean, it could happen. I think it would be unlikely, but I mean, it's certainly possible.
Mm, okay. And your specific research on the Zika?
Yeah, so I co-authored a paper on Zika virus. It was almost 10 years ago now, back when no one really paid too much attention to the virus. But I also work, I have collaborators in Mexico. We interact a lot. So I want to begin some Zika virus research with my colleagues in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. What do you see happening on a grand scale in this hemisphere? It seems to be exploding in the areas of Mexico, Latin America, South America. Will this continue?
Yeah, it'll spread all throughout tropical America. So the virus will spread all throughout South America, Central America, the Caribbean, and Mexico. Pretty much everywhere where Aedes aegypti is found, which unfortunately is a large chunk of the Americas.
Okay, well, let's hope for a vaccine soon. Thank you very much, Brad Blitvich, Associate Professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at ISU, studies mosquito-transmitted viruses. Brad, thanks you so much.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Well, finally today, the lineup for the Hinterland Music Festival has just been announced. It's a two-day event, August 5th and 6th this year, aimed at all those who love both music and the outdoors. It's held, as the name would indicate, in the Hinterland. This is in St. Charles, an area just outside of Des Moines. And this annual festival featuring music, camping, arts, crafts, vendors, really aiming to be, I think, a family event. Sam Summers is organizer of the Hinterland Music Festival, joining us now by phone. Hello, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. We want to hear some music here and as we end this program from some of the lineup. But tell us, who is featured?
So this year, we're real excited that we've got, for headliners, we've got Willie Nelson and Ray LaMontagne. So, you know, that's great headliners, but we've also got really good support.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of Willie Nelson quickly. Going way back, I know he has a new album out, but this is a well-known piece that, well, we would assume he would reel out for the Hinterland Festival. Whiskey River from 1973. Let's listen to a little bit of Willie Nelson.
Whiskey River, take my mind. No better memory torture me. Whiskey River, don't run dry. You're all I got to care for me. Whiskey River, take my mind.
All right, there'll be a lot of people showing up for Willie Nelson. I've met Willie Nelson in my teens, actually, Sam. I was taking room service to him at a hotel room here in Iowa. It was not whiskey, though, that I smelled in the air in his hotel room, as is well known by Willie Nelson. Ray, tell us a little bit. For those who don't know Ray LaMontagne, tell us about him. We'll hear something from him as well.
Yeah, so he's a folk artist. You know, his career spans over the last 10 years, lots of great releases. And this tour is actually on a new record he's putting out that was produced by Jim James from My Morning Jacket. So what's cool about this tour that we're a part of is the entire rest of the band, My Morning Jacket, will be backing him that night. So
That's really cool. So tell us, this is the second year of the festival. It was not held in this area last year, was it?
So it was originally scheduled to be up in Waterworks Park last summer. We moved to this location due to flooding here, Avenue of the Saints in St. Charles. And it worked so nice for us last year. We wanted to come back and, you know, it really helped us accommodate all the camping and all that sort of stuff. So we love the location that we're in this year.
I see in your lineup you have Lake Street Dive. There is it has an Iowa component in it. Bridget Carney, Iowa City native, bassist, also songwriter for the group. This is an amazing group that has, well, it's about 10 years old, the group, but recently, I think thanks a lot to Stephen Colbert, has just exploded and now tours the continent and also the world, doesn't it?
Right, yeah, such a great musical group. We had them 2 years ago down at Simon Estes Amphitheater in Des Moines, and just such a captivating performance. It was a really good show.
Okay, we want to go out with a little bit of Lake Street Dive's new music, their newest single off their album Side Pony, actually just released. But tell us, before we go into a little Lake Street Dive to end the program, Sam Summers, organizer of the Hinterland Music Festival, how can people find out more about the festival, the cost, and so forth?
Yeah, so tickets actually went on sale today. You can grab them over at hinterlandiowa.com. So we expect it to be a hot ticket this year, so I'd head over there and grab those.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sam Summers of Hinterland Music Festival.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Let's end this News Buzz edition of River to River with some Lake Street Dive. Side Pony is the title of this music. Let's listen to it a little bit.
I'm not going to bat you. Just want to latch. You got me wishing that I never said hello. Don't want to fight. I don't got a right to. This is what I get for being civilized. I apologize.
Okay, the amazing voice of Rachel Price with lead vocals. That big bass, that big, fat, funky bass, courtesy of Iowa City native Bridget Carney. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go out with a Lake Street Dive, and we hope your weekend is anything but a dive. Enjoy the weather. Take care.